We're in the third week of our series. How many have been here through the whole thing? Okay, we've gone through being single. We've gone through dating. We've gone last week through how marriage is one of the most powerful ways in the world for you to get a selfie, for you to get a look in the mirror of what you look like, to show where your heart is, even if you don't realize it, because marriage will do that. It will bring out the real you like nothing in the world. Amen? And to help us grow in our humbleness and in our sacrifice. And in the word we've thrown around so much in Sunday school, agape. This week we're going to focus in on one issue because this issue is so important. It's going to springboard off what we talked about last week. And it's the one major issue that weakens and destroys so many marriages. And I don't care how long you've been married or how good your marriage is or whether you've never been married. This is something you got to put in your arsenal. It will make or break your marriage. Mainly, again, because we use the mindset and the ways of the world in a covenant that was created by God. And we can't use the things the world teach us and keep a holy and awesome and righteous covenant that we made before God and according to God and His ways of loving. So we have to erase the world's way of thinking as we're going into this marriage seminar. What we do when we apply the world to our marriages is you end up cheapening your marriage and cheating your spouse out of so much, and you miss everything God has for us. So this is so important, and I'm going to tell you what, there is nothing I love more than doing these marriage seminars. And if none of you get anything out of it, if I can go through one of these marriage seminars about every 2 or 3 years, my wife appreciates it so much. Because I don't care how hard you're trying, you're going to fall back into the ways of the world unless you're reminded. And it's just wonderful to have to sit down and study for hours and hours and hours all the things that I've begun to do wrong again. And God straightens me up. So we're going to see how God means for us to do it again. And I'm going to tell you something. One of the hardest things about going into something like this, listen, is what happens is you realize when you hear this, especially those of you that have been married, man, I've been doing this wrong for so long. How am I going to make it up now? Have you ever been wrong for so long that to admit you're wrong now would mean you've wasted so much time and done it wrong for so long you'd rather just fight to try and prove your way is right so you won't feel bad about all the time you've missed? Have you ever done that? Don't. Just, here's the deal. I love this little slide. It's never too late to be what you might have been. But don't leave it a second longer. Okay? I don't care if you've been doing marriage wrong for 30 years. If that woman or that man is still hung with your sorry honey, then surprise them and just admit you were wrong all this time and come out of the corner brand new. Don't hang on to something just because it's the way you've always been and you hate to admit it now. And I have seen that so often in couples that have been together for some time. Here's the deal. Listen to me. This makes so much sense. If you've got the history of doing it wrong, if you've got the most history of all, then what that gives you is the inspiration and the passion and the experience to want to do it right, better, and harder than anybody that's just starting. Because you know what it's like to have done it wrong. You've got the experiences. You've felt the pain. And there's nothing that can take the place of that. As awful as it was when Brenda and I, the one time in our lives, almost called it quits, I wouldn't trade that now. Because I can think back on that and think, that was the worst moment, the worst weeks, the worst months of my life. I won't ever want to go. I would rather die than go back to that. So, for a little while today, I want you to focus completely on this and decide to apply yourself to whatever God shows you, okay? Let's revisit our key verse and a couple of other verses here very quickly. Ephesians 5:31. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. And again, Mark 10:6-9. But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and join to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then, they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate. How many times do you hear that in a wedding? Excuse me, Genesis 2:24, the last time. And I'm saying this for a reason. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife. They shall become one flesh. They were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. Now, that's just three times that it's just almost identical with a few additional comments on both sides. God repeats it again and again and again, that in marriage, two become one. And it's very apparent because nothing tears a person apart more than divorce, more so than death. I'm telling you, I've seen a lot of people that would have handled death in their family a lot easier than divorce, because it tears out a part of you because you become one. And Ephesians, again, I'm going to come back to this again and again. Ephesians said the great mystery, the comparison. If you want to understand marriage, for those of you that were not here, I'll throw this out to you very quickly. God says if you want to understand marriage, look at Jesus and the church relationship and how they're supposed to love each other. And everything you can understand about that relationship, you can apply to your marriage. It's a great mystery. But there's the key. Okay? So a lot of the stuff we're studying will be from there. Now, I want you to think for a minute. Usually I see a lot of elbows flying in services like this. Of the love and the humbleness. Listen to me. Those of you that have never been married, I want you to really focus in on what I'm saying because you're going to face it. The love and the humbleness that it takes for this to really occur, for two people to become one. We have all these wonderful, awesome pictures of how this beautiful marriage is, two people coming together, and you just don't have any idea what that entails. Think about it. Your wants, listen to me, your desires, your views in life, your opinions, your passions, your beliefs, your habits, your everyday choices and quirks all have to be incorporated into the life of another person. I can look at some of you from here and tell just how difficult that would be and how crazy the ride will be to incorporate that into the life of another. Not only incorporate it, but you are supposed to blend it to who they are until you become one with them. Think about that. Learning to do everything differently. Not allow them to live their life and you live yours. That's sometimes the way the world thinks. No, you are to blend as one. Now, here we go. Look at this. What that means is, look at these things. Convictions, what you believe about God, what you don't believe, what you're convicted about spiritually. Your recreation, what you do on your own time. How you're going to handle money. The friends you're going to keep and not keep, and what you're going to do with your friends. How you're going to keep house. That's a massive deal. How you're going to raise your children. The food you're going to eat in your house and how it's going to be cooked. Even how you fight. I am telling you, a lot of times part of all of the counseling we do is teaching people how to fight. Usually I try to teach the woman to use her legs, get a lot of power in there. And the men, no. You're going to fight. How do you fight? Respectfully, lovingly? You've got to get through things. Oh my gosh, if you're going to go through all that with another human being that has different thoughts, raised differently, different attitude, different hormones, different everything, and you're going to bring all that together and not fight. Think about it. It's how you fight, not fighting. Now, everybody, when you get married, you have to give and take in every one of these areas, no exceptions, with love and respect until you result in a new person. Maybe a schizophrenic person, but a new person. The only way you get closer than that is if you just took parts off both of them and discarded them and made somebody new, and God's got that covered too. But, except for that, there is no way two people can become one any more than in marriage. And it requires massive amounts of effort. And what the problem becomes is this. We step into this, a world where the utmost respect and sharing and selflessness and humility is required to become one person. And we step into it with the world's mentality and we create hell on earth. Because it won't work. It cannot work. The institution of marriage was given by God with God's rules. And you try to do it with the world's rules and you might as well throw it out and go ahead and do whatever you want to do because it ain't working. So, now, listen close. Bring it in. Focus. Every marriage that ever has a problem, ever. What'd I say? ever starts with one common denominator. One or both partners' absolute refusal to change. Did you hear me? Most people go into a marriage thinking this new partner is going to just uplift and expand on and compliment them and make their life better. Do you think you're going to join with someone and become a new person in all the areas I just talked to you about, and you're not going to have to change yourself immensely? Yet everybody goes into marriage thinking they won't change, their spouse will. Thinking they shouldn't have to change, or it wouldn't be real love. Well, you chose me for who I am. Why should I have to change? That's a real good question. And I honestly understand why people say that, and we're going to address that. But don't you dare, if you haven't been married, and don't you dare think it's okay 10 years into the marriage that you haven't changed. If you haven't changed, you have done your spouse a terrible injustice. You are called to change. And I will show you why it is God's plan to change when you get married. You think that sounds crazy? I'm going to show you scripturally why that's true. When I say what I did, you should change. Here are the two things that I get from people the most. One, they knew who I was before they married me. I have heard this exact phrase many times. They knew who I was before they married me. They shouldn't expect me to change now. They can't deal with who I am. They shouldn't have married me. They knew it. You ever heard anybody say that when they have trouble in their marriages? My polite response to that is, shut up. You selfish, conceited person. The second thing I often hear is, it would be hypocritical to be something different just to please my spouse. Both of those, I was joking with the first one, both of those do make sense, don't they? You want me to get married and then be someone different? That's kind of hypocritical. I'll just change for you. That's not really who I am. You want me to be somebody different? You want me to become an actress to make my spouse happy? Not at all. Hang with me, okay? Let's take a moment and look at both of these briefly before we go any further, because if we don't get past these questions, you're not going to buy into what I'm telling you. And again, 90% of all the material I will give you came from the Doss household and how usually I screw up. So I'm not just talking scripture, I'm talking a lot of experience. All right? All right, first off, let's address the first question. Well, they knew who I was before they married me. They shouldn't expect me to change now. I'm going to start out with a question. How many people have ever been to college here? How many people hope to go to college? Okay, guess what? When you apply for college, they want to learn something about you, what you've done, who you are, what you're excited about, where you're going, right? Because they're going to decide to accept you or not accept you according to who you are right now. So that's great. That means they check me out before I go in. And when I go to college, I won't have to change a bit. Nope. Not true. When you go to college, you're expected to be there because they want to make a better student and a better person out of you. And they expect you to change in what you know. They expect you to change in your total thought process. Half of college is your thought process. They expect you to change in what you want to go after and what you're thinking about and how you're thinking about it. They want you to be a totally new person. But they want to know who you were before you got there. But they hope to change you. How many of you have ever joined the military? When you sign up for the military, they want to know a lot about you. From what your mentality is, to how many push-ups you can do, to how good you can run. They want to know about all your abilities, accomplishments, and your beliefs. And does the military expect you to change after you get there? Not at all. Not at all. That's why when you first get there, they scream in your face and shave all your hair off and make you look just like everybody else. And you don't eat the same, and you don't decide when you're going to get up or when you're going to go to bed or what you're going to do. Your whole life is planned for you. But there's no change at all. They accepted you the way you were, conditioned that when you got there, they knew you would change. You're not changing the person you are on the inside, but you're changing habits, you're changing abilities, you're changing thought processes, you're changing ways of relating, you're changing ways of doing. They're not changing the core person of who you are. That's who you will always be. But change is good in some respects. How about When you apply for a job or when you join a sport, they want to know everything about you they can find out in both. But when you get there, their sole purpose when you first get there is to do what? To change you, to grow you into something that you were not before. Because if you don't adapt, you won't survive in your new environment. Correct? You join the military and you don't let me change you, and I throw you out on the battlefield. Holy moly! You're going to die. So I did you a favor by changing something about you. So don't give me this junk about how hypocritical it is that you'll accept me as I am, but yet you'll expect me to change. What I expect you to do is be the person that you are, but change your mode of operation in marriage, and I'll show you why. Listen closely to me. Listen to this question. You ready, class? Say amen.
Amen.
Did Jesus Christ have to change when he chose to love us into heaven? Be careful how you answer. Yes. I want you to listen. Jesus Christ, God Almighty, you can't get much better than that. He changed. Philippians 2:4. Let each of you look not only for his own interest, but also for the interest of others. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, but changed himself, taking the form of a bondservant, coming in the likeness of men, being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself, became obedient to the point of death, even to the death of a cross. You think this isn't the same? Well, that's a foul ball, Doug. It doesn't mean the same when Jesus did that. Jesus became something completely out of his nature. Did he not? Completely foreign to what he was before. He completely changed. He became less than he was in some ways, although he maintained who he was as God, just to meet the needs of his beloved, because he saw we had a need that only he could meet, and he changed whatever he had to change about himself to meet our need at a great expense to himself. Did he change who he was in his nature as God? No, he was still Jesus Christ. But there is nothing else that could be changed that he didn't change in order to meet our needs. Do you understand where I'm going with this? Jesus was God. That never changed. But everything else in his life, all to the detriment of how he would live, he changed. Because nothing was too sacred in his happy little comfy life. Nothing was too sacred to change to come and save us. Now, let me ask you this. Did he expect you to change when you came to him? I'm glad you got that one right. Now, does he love you where you are? Yep. Will he love you if you screw up all the days of your life? Yep. But is he hoping that you will change? Yep. Why? What's the motivation? Listen, key point. The motivation for why God, even though he accepts you the way you are, loves you the way you are, has hopes that in your relationship with him you will choose to change is this. He hopes your motivation is you love him so much and you can meet a need and a desire that he has, and your love for him makes you so desperate to meet that need that you will change anything in your life to the cost of everything you own to meet that need and to love him the way he loves you. That is what he hopes your motivation is for change. You are still you. But he wants you to grab hold of holiness. He wants you to change your life and your thoughts. He wants you to become something that will be pleasing to him and give you a better relationship with him. So you better believe he wants us to change. But you better believe he loves us right where we are, no matter what we do, whether we get to that change or not. Wait. The relationship of Christ and the church is the great mystery of the way it should be between a husband and a wife. So guess what that means? That means that in love, you hope that your spouse's motivation is that they will change anything and everything they can to meet your needs and love you. But just in case they don't, you will continue to love them as they are, in hopes that they will see you, love you, and grow to meet your needs, which requires change. Don't be afraid of change. And don't think it's wrong to ask change of your spouse or of yourself. It is expected. It is the key show of agape love. Agape love, the choice to love, comes through action. That action can only be to change things from where they are to meet the need of another. Agape love means change. I will do what it takes to love you. That means I've got to change my direction. I've got to change my life. I've got to change something to meet your needs. Because it's no longer me and my direction I'm thinking about. It's yours. Does that make sense? So get over the whole thing of change is bad. Okay? With that said, what about it would be hypocritical for me to change who I am just to love you? First of all, you need to attach some rubber to your shoes because you're going to get a lightning bolt for calling Jesus hypocritical. Because he changed for you. But that's a very good point. Oh, you want me to marry you, but then you want me to change and be who you want. Well, if I'm somebody else, then that's I'm being a hypocrite. Nope. All right, pay attention. It'll all make sense. And you'll be like, oh, you got a moment here. Okay? Listen to this. On the contrary, from what we've seen about choosing to love, listen, it actually would be hypocritical to see something in your life that hurts your spouse or doesn't meet the need of your spouse and you don't change. That is hypocritical. Did you hear what I said? You can say all day, well, it's just hypocritical to change. And I'm telling you, if you see a need or if you see a pain that you've caused and your immediate desire is not to change into anything it takes to no longer hurt or no longer be helpless to your spouse, then you're being a hypocrite for swearing that you love somebody and in no way doing anything to meet their needs. That's a hypocrite. So turn it around and see it as it is. And take a look at what Paul says about this whole hypocritical change thingy. 1 Corinthians 9:19. This is what Paul says. For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win the more. And to the Jew, I became as a Jew. Are you a hypocrite? That I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as those under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law. Not being without law towards God, but under law towards Christ. That I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. Now this I do for the gospel's sake, that I might be partakers of it with you. Man, Paul couldn't have made that any clearer. He says, with every crowd I get with, I will blend in and I will do and be whatever it takes to relate to them. And you know what your immediate action would be if you're trying to think like the world? You hypocrite? Well, absolutely not. This is, in essence, what Paul is. Paul is saying, I have such a love for you. Listen. I have such a love for you that my identity doesn't matter. All that matters to me is loving you. And whatever I have to become to reach you, I will do. Because who I am is a lover of you. And whatever that takes and whatever changes is requested or needed from day to day, that's what I will be. Because all that I am, my whole essence, is the one that loves you. In any way that is necessary. Is that not the most beautiful thing you could possibly hear? And that's what Paul is saying. My love for you is who I am. I don't lose my identity. I don't lose my convictions. I don't lose my heart. It stays intact. That's the whole reason I will change. Because whatever it is I need to reach you is what I will do. That is awesome. It's out of a love and a heartfelt desire to relate to others that he did this. And it became the description of who he was. The description of who you are ought to be whatever it takes to love my spouse. Do you get that? Now, I had a clip that I was going to show you and it messed up. Okay, I don't say watch this movie. It's the most wonderful movie I have ever seen to show agape love in action. But it has one scene of extramarital affair, of sex before marriage. And I don't agree with that. So I have to count the movie out. But other than that, there has never been a secular movie to show God's view of agape love than The Notebook in my life. Not that I watch chick flicks. I was watching, I told my Sunday school class, I shouldn't tell you this. I was watching the clip last night, not this clip, but another clip that I was going to use downstairs. I'm downstairs, it's 3 a.m, I'm all by myself. It's a 3-minute clip. And I literally had tears dripping off my cheek. True story. It tore me. I can't watch it. It tore me up. And anytime I watch something like that with my family, they don't even watch the TV. They stare at me. And I'm like, I'm going to be the man, right? I'm like, that's when I have to get up and go get more pizza. But now listen, a young Noah is trying to win a young Allie, and he hardly knows her. And he's got it down. He is Paul to the umpth degree. Listen to what he says. I'm going to quote off the movie. Young Noah comes up to her. He's trying to get her to give him a chance, and she won't. And he stops her on the main street, and he says, I could be fun if you want. I could be pensive, smart, superstitious, brave. And I could be light on my feet. I can be whatever you want. You just tell me what you want, and I'm going to be that for you. And she looks at him. She says, you're dumb. And he says, I can be that. Because he is saying, the only thing real about me is my love for you. And whatever it takes me to show you that, that's what I'll be. Man, that is rocking. That's not hypocritical. That is the ultimate form of love. And it's why your marriages fail, because you don't have an ultimate form of love. You have an ultimate form of self-love, starting with me. And you will be who you are, come hell nor high water, divorce or fussing, ruining everybody's life. I am who I am, and you chose me to love me for who I am. And if you can't deal with that, well, so be it. You've got no idea what God's love of agape is. Because God would strike all of that and be whatever it takes to meet the needs of your spouse. Period. I don't care what your excuse. I don't care how you were raised. I don't care what your personality. You look at your spouse. What do they need? That's what you are. And that's what Jesus did for us. That is Jesus' way of thinking versus the world's. This is the one true way. And it also brings out the best in someone. I've already had people answer this question for me in the past few weeks. How many of you, and I'll raise my hand first, got the strength to come out of a very bad habit or a lifestyle? You were able to change yourself because of your love for another human being. You stopped bad habits. You turned your life around. You became someone different because the person that you loved didn't like who you were, and you were willing to do and be anything in that change to meet their needs. That's what you're supposed to do. Why is it we can do it for something like that, but we can't do it for something simple? Why are you so hesitant not to change habits that are simple and not terrible? But, let me tell you, the simple ones, the ones that seem to be easily overlooked, are sometimes the most damaging and most hurtful. Did you hear me? What do you do as a habit that you know always hurts your spouse's feelings, always drives a wedge, always causes an argument, and it's not a big deal, and nobody else would care, but every time it ever happens, it causes a problem between you and your spouse. And the only thing you can say is live with it. God, my gosh, it's not a big deal. Well, true love, agape love, would say, okay, if it's not a big deal, and it's always a point of contention, and it hurts that bad, and it means that much to you, what difference does it make? I'll change. Do you know how I don't like speaking these words to you, knowing me? But we all need to hear it. Has anybody ever lit a unity candle in a marriage? It's the most beautiful thing in the world, because lighting one candle symbolizes two lives blending as one. Now, before we go any further, I want you to look at the happy bride, and then I want you to take a look at that face. That just brings it all home. And I will show you what he has in his mind. I mean, his face just says it all. But now, those two candles come together, two lives becoming one, right? Now, what do they do next? They extinguish the other two candles. Why? Those two lives are over. They have now become one. And if two lives become one, that took a whole lot of change. Right? You just took two totally different lifestyles and blended them into one. God sees us literally as one the rest of our life. And a more beautiful picture, has anybody ever seen using the sands? Two different lifestyles, two different colors, two different ways pour together to form something new in change that can never be undone again. That is totally awesome. Perfect picture of what God's saying. Meaning two lives disappear and merge into one, but yet you don't want to change. I mean, you type things in and you think, I'll never get a picture to represent this. Well, I did. If we want to be honest, when you see two people light unity candles, I say tell them to get rid of the candles and light them with blow torches. You know why? And I actually found a picture. It's called My Redneck Wedding. They are lighting a unity candle. See her wedding dress? The reason I say this is because once you light the new life, can you blow out a blowtorch? No! And while you're trying to light that new candle, you will probably burn it to the ground. True or false? So it is the absolute best picture of a marriage done in the world's way. You're not extinguishing my little light, baby. I ain't changing. And while we're trying to do our little thing, I'm going to melt your butt. That's where some of us are right now. Whew. I bet once they cut everything that needs to be cut out of this, this will be a 5-minute sermon you can give to your friends. I don't know. Everything in our fallen nature screams accountability to no one but ourselves. I am my own person. And then marriage reverses that completely. You're totally accountable to another person. And we all resist this to a degree. But some of you have suffered for years. Listen to me. This is where it gets serious. Some of you have been married for years and still have not learned to compromise, change, anything. To the point, here's where it gets real, that every day, every simple issue in your life is a battlefield. And I know there's people here right now that live that way. I know there are. The simplest discussion can become a heated battle that can lead to days of anger, sometimes weeks. Days of silence over the simplest stuff. And people from the outside, not knowing all the contention, would look and say, how in the world did you get in that big of a fight over that? And then they get married and they realize how. Because you're not willing to change. Both or one just refuse to give in, refuse to change their stance on anything. It's all a power struggle. You will give in. You will be wrong. You will look dumb. I will not. And they both get that mentality. And even one that's passive sometimes eventually gets to the point, I'm not backing up anymore. I'm so tired of it. And so they finally stomp their little foot down and say, I'm not backing up another inch. From now on, you'll fight for every inch you get. And every day, every moment is a battlefield. Even if nobody else sees it, they know it's there. Ask yourself, is this my house? To a small degree or a large degree? Is this me? Better yet, ask your spouse. Everybody but me. There are several key reasons that one, oh, there's my picture of a blowtorch. Sorry, I missed that. Several key reasons that one or both spouses might resist change when they become one in a marriage. And three things I'm going to tell you. And here it is. You already know, you've already tagged yourself in whether or not you accept change in a marriage, and whether or not you've decided to change and be everything that your spouse needs to make this marriage work, or whether you have been one that has decided, this is who I am, this is who you married. If you don't like it, there's a front door. Somebody out there is going to like me better than you. Nah, you just missed it all. You know where you stand. If you stand there, or if your spouse stands there, I'm going to give you the three top reasons why we do that, and then talk about them scripturally, and we'll be done. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on any of them, but they're important. This is the root cause behind why we refuse to change. As we spoke of last week, we brought this first thing up last week, and now I'm going to show you the results of its power when we mess it up. The first reason, you're just too proud and too selfish to consider someone else's ways. I got to hit the most blatant, most probable cause first, and then we'll get into the side notes. You're walking in pride, you're walking in flesh, you're not walking in the love of Christ. You have no humbleness, and you're just not going to play that game. 1 Corinthians 13, 4. Listen closely. Based on what we're talking about, based on giving in, based on changing for your spouse, listen to this verse like you've never heard it. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up, does not behave rudely, does not, what class? Seek its own. Pride and selfishness causes us to think, listen, my intelligence and my righteousness is superior. I shouldn't have to change to match you, because when you compare me to you, I'm usually right and you're usually wrong. And I am usually more holy than thou art. And you're usually more worldly. So anytime we have a discussion, that's why I stand by my guns, because I'm usually superior. Now, you're probably not going to say that for hopes that you don't get throat punched. But it's what a lot of you think. And you know what's sad? I know it's what a lot of you think because I see it on your face even in church. Even when you address your spouse in church, your attitude, your eyes, your sarcasm tell me even in church, you think, who are you to argue with me? I got this. You don't. And you begin to think you don't ever have to consider the ways or the wants of your spouse. It's their job to cater to you, and it's their job to listen to your enlightening ideas. Well, you can have your wonderful enlightening ideas all by yourself with your 20 cats after you've run them off, because you're destined to become a widowed cat lady. Because you're not going to keep a spouse that way. It's not up to them to please you. It's not up to them to always bow to your better way. Because sometimes, listen to me, class, sometimes it's not all about having it your way or even having it the smartest way. Sometimes it's about honoring and loving the other person. Sometimes it's about just loving them and putting them first. Sometimes it's about respecting them and their thoughts. Sometimes it might be the best in your eyes, but you were raised differently and you have a different thought process. And in their mind, their idea is just as good. And it really doesn't matter who wins the argument, because does God really care about what's going on if it's not a moral issue? Or does he care about your relationship and how much you love and how much you give and how much you change and how much you surrender? In that respect, who wins and who loses, even though you stomp your little foot and prove why you're right in your selfishness and your pride? But two people will stand there toe-to-toe for days and stomp and snort like bulls at each other over one dumb little issue and will lose everything God had for them in their relationship. And not one thought goes into how am I making them feel? Have they been honored? Has our relationship grown? It's just, did I walk out of here with you understanding that I'm superior? The second one, insecurity and self-consciousness. Now I want you to listen close to this. Insecurity. Sometimes you have to cover up your own insecurity and your feelings of inferiority. Listen to me. Some people have had such bad lives and such abuse in the past, and they feel so insecure, and now they've got only one defense. They put up this wall, and everything I want to do and everything I want to say, I always feel like it'll probably be wrong, and you probably will be smarter, and I can't let you see that. So I will put up the front, and I will back you down, and I will act tough. Do you know anybody like that? Are you that person? I'm going to cover my insecurities because I will prove my way is best no matter what, because you're not going to make fun of me anymore. I've had it with being made fun of. And I'm never going to back down or say I'm wrong again because I'm tired of it. Sometimes the most cold, the most angry, the most shallow and cutting and fighting person that you will ever see, the most hurtful and loud and arrogant person, is the most insecure and hurting person on the out in the room. Have you ever seen that? Someone you know personally is screaming on the inside that they feel like they're just nothing, they're nobody, and everybody in the room is better than them. But when you see them step up to the plate, they bark like a pit bull because they're hiding that insecurity. Now listen, In reality, this problem that comes from your insecurity, before you go showing pity and, oh, I really feel bad for people like that, let me ask you a question. If you're listening, give me a wave. Do you not think this insecurity, lashing out in an insecurity, is based on the same core of pride? Did you hear what I said? You're insecure, so you got to stand up and you got to prove yourself right because you just don't want the world to see just how insecure you are. Guess what your core problem still is? Pride. Basically, insecurity, listen to this, is simply pride with nothing left. You don't have anything to be proud about. So you're just going to hang on to pride with nothing behind it. But you still got your pride. You'll still stomp and snort and care about nobody but yourself, and you don't even have anything to back it up. It's still pride. I don't care if it is your insecurity that makes you lash out. It's still you thinking about you over anybody else. And an insecure person that is humble will be the first one to say, I don't know, teach me. I've never known. I probably know less than anybody in this room. Teach me. Boy, I respect you for who you are. Show me. That's an insecure person who's humble. An insecure person who's proud will snort and stomp and spit and make you think they just know everything and back you in a corner because they'd rather hurt you because their thoughts are only on self. Are you with me, class? So don't use your insecurity as a reason to be mean to people. You're still prideful. Now I'm going to throw you a curveball. The third reason may take you by surprise a little bit. It's easy to feel, if you live with somebody like this, somebody that's demanding and fussy and uncompromising and unbending, you're the victim. It's easy to feel very righteous and like you've been done so wrong. And sometimes there's no way around it that they really are that way, and there's not a lot you're going to do about it, but wait them out and pray. But let me tell you, class, sometimes you'll be living with a person that lashes out, and they're uncompromising, and they're unbending, and they always seem short. And yes, it's their sin, and yes, it's their problem, right? But I want you to listen. You have to look really close at the situation and realize if you're with a spouse that is doing this, they'd be more to blame than realize. Maybe even more to blame than them in some areas. Now hang with me and I'll explain. Sometimes your spouse is cold and controlling and unbending because they fear, listen, they fear the condemnation that you put on them. Look at me and listen to me a minute. If you have a spouse that always has to prove they're right and always has to bark and spit and fight, then you need to stop and ask yourself, well, am I being humble and loving to them and they're just treating me terrible, which may be the case? Or do I ever show them how wrong they are? Maybe they started the vicious circle, but for whatever reason, do I mainly condemn more than I lift up? Do I mainly knock down what they do instead of telling them how awesome they are? Might your spouse feel like they've lost control because on everything, anywhere, anytime, you're going to have the final answer on what you're going to do? Even if it's in manipulation, you will have the final say on what you do. And yet you wonder why they want to fight and struggle. Not once do you ever consider them and respect them for who they are and ask them what they would like. It's always, we will do it my way, until you have forced them, even against sometimes their very nature, to stand up and snarl at you because they're tired of being a doormat. Some people feel like they are being judged so much that they will not change a light bulb in front of their spouse because their spouse will have something to say about how they should have done it differently. Can I get a witness? And you live in that for so long, what is your defense mechanism going to be? You'll eventually get fleshy and you'll begin to stand up and say, you're not judging me anymore. I'll tell you why I did it. Sometimes Even against a spouse's very nature, you will help them to sin. It's still their choice. But you will help them along the road because everything you do is condemning and judgmental until you force them to take a stand. They can't be mild-mannered. They can't be sweet because every time they are, you kick them in a corner until they can't take it anymore. And then you turn around and raise Cain about how bad they treat you and how controlling they are and how they always fuss about everything, never realizing the flame you're throwing on it from your side. Never realizing you're helping to create this monster at best, or at least keeping the vicious cycle going, because you're no better. Are they still sinning? Yeah. But have you helped your spouse to increase and fester in their sin? Yeah. If you're not doing your part by backing off and loving non-judgmentally, no matter what they've done, and not using them as an excuse, then it's your problem. And don't worry about their problem until you settle your problem. Are you with me? Look at these top three answers on the board and tell me if it describes you in your relationship. If it does, not only is it okay to change in a relationship, it's mandatory, or else you're not being the person God called you to be. Now, listen close. This is important. Pride will often lose a hold of someone when they get hit. This is what you can do, people. This is so awesome. And if it doesn't work, you should do it anyway. It's your calling. I want you to listen to me. If you have a spouse like this, pride will often lose its hold when you hit it with real love and acceptance. Did you get that word? They're acceptable and claim that they're acceptable and respectable to you. Oh, need. He didn't say they have to have it. Now listen, this is what this does. This person's chosen you for life, so they can't be all bad. Or maybe that means they are. They've chosen you for life. They've committed their life to you. They're living with you. Whatever problems they have is now your problem because you saw something in them worth devoting your whole life to. Now, here's what happens. If a person truly, even if they don't deserve it, even if they don't reciprocate for months, maybe years, if they truly feel appreciated and cherished for their abilities and their efforts and who they are, and they don't listen, they no longer have to forcibly assert who they are. They no longer have to forcibly prove every day they are worthy of the value that you're going to put on them. They no longer have to feel bad when they're in your presence for wondering what you think of them. Do you ever walk into the presence of someone and just being around certain people you know don't like you make you feel less of a person while you're around them and you just got to get away from them because you feel bad about who you are when you're there? Do you ever know anybody like that? Well, my gosh, what about when you create that atmosphere for your spouse and you realize every time they're around you, they feel bad about who they are? How much worse could it get? If you will change yourself so that your spouse doesn't fight for your acceptance, your spouse doesn't hope they're accepted in your eyes, whenever they're around you, they feel the value that you put on them. They feel accepted even if they mess up. You don't challenge their every decision. You don't challenge their every thought. You don't condemn everything they do. When they're around you, they can finally get a breath of fresh air and feel good about who they are, even if they don't deserve it. Then that ugly head of pride will begin to dissipate because they don't have to prove anything to you. There is no battle when the other person won't fight back. Are you getting what I'm saying? I won't have a pride issue if I don't have to. If you've already shown me that I'm okay, why do I have to have pride to prove it? I feel it when I'm with you. I'm accepted. I don't have to prove myself. I don't have to stand up and rear out at you like a lion. You've already put me there. That's how you beat it. When all can be safely surrendered to somebody without fear, pride has nothing to fight, nothing to gain, nothing to conquer. 1 John 4:18. Listen to it in light of what we're talking about, people. There is no fear in love. How many of us could stop right there and say, oop, blew it. Soiled it. Soiled it. But perfect love casts out. Perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment. Whoever fears has not been perfected in love. I don't want to read this because I mess up so bad. But this is saying literally, listen, for fear doesn't have to do with punishment. I mean, fear has to do with punishment. Do you punish your spouse with unknown criticism and condemnation? How many of us do? Don't raise your hand. Then you're not loving the way God would have us to love. And you may be adding to their sins. I want you to listen to one earlier verse really quickly and how it applies to what we're talking about. Everything in light of what we're talking about. Genesis 2:24, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. They shall become one flesh. I added this on, next verse. And they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. Well, Doug, what in the world does that have to do with anything? The intimacy of marriage, listen, the intimacy of marriage exposes everything about you. Naked physically is small next to the nakedness that marriage brings to two people. The strengths and the weaknesses and the faults and the problems, you know about your spouse more intimately than anyone in the world. You stand naked before them like no one else. Is that true or not? You know things about your spouse no one else knows and probably never will know. An intimacy that exposes everything. You are completely naked before them in many ways. This means, with that knowledge, you better listen to me. With that knowledge, you alone have the power with your spouse to be their armor or to be the arrow that kills them. Like no one in the world. And guess what most of us choose to be based on that knowledge? Based on your knowledge, listen, your knowledge of what drives them, what their darkest problems are, what their sins are, what their worries are, what their insecurities are. Based on that, you have more power in your hands to create the perfect environment for your spouse to grow them and cultivate them in acceptance or to make them feel every day as though they're being judged. You can do that like no other in the world. What are you doing with it? Are you hurting them? Are you purposely trying to help them? Or are you so busy with yourself you haven't created an environment at all? It's just whatever happens, happens, which is usually what happens in my family. You alone have the power, the privilege, and the necessity before God to create the atmosphere of acceptance for your spouse based on your knowledge of them. You, besides God, Jesus Christ Himself, may be the biggest factor of your spouse's self-esteem their entire life. What have you done to it? First John 4:19. I added one on to this. I want you to hear it all again. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, for fear has to do with punishment. Whoever fears has not been perfected in love. We love because, what, class? He first loved us. Now, okay, let's go back to it. Christ in the church is a mystery of what? Okay, so we love Him because He first loved. Mystery revealed. When a person, it summarizes what I've just told you. When a person is unconditionally, unstoppably loved and desired, it's so much easier for them to return love. You can melt the hardest heart if you've got the time, if you've got the patience, if you have the true love to do so. Just like in your relationship with Jesus Christ. Listen, true unity can only occur in an atmosphere of real love and acceptance. And that's why we so often feel distant from our spouses, myself greatly included, because I haven't created an atmosphere of true acceptance, of true love. And we can't be one because we don't feel like we can be ourselves. We always have something to prove. You're supposed to be naked and unashamed before each other. There is no your side. There is no my side. There is our side. And when you begin to see it as our side, whatever happens, we will get through this. It changes your whole perspective. I'm telling you, it changes it. And every time you get bitter and you start getting those old feelings, then you begin to realize, I put her or him on that side, and I've got this side, and I've got to come back to the same side. And it's got to be us, unstoppable against everything else. In our environment of accepting each other, no matter what our faults. And that means you change to be whatever you have to be to make it work. What do you do with all this? I'll repeat an earlier statement. Almost every problem ever experienced in a marriage stems from somebody's decision not to change, not to compromise, not to love the other person more than they love themselves, not to love the other person so much they're willing to change things that even aren't a problem as long as it will help grow the other person. So what do you do with what we talked about today? This. First, you need to ask yourself in all openness, just yourself, did he describe me today? And if the answer is yeah, then ask yourself, what do you need to change? What, even down to the simplest habits, what things do I do that always cause hardship and problems and pain and argument? What things can I just simply change? Don't even have to tell them. If you go tell them all the things you've changed and you glory in it, I'm sorry, you just blew it. What do you need to compromise? What do you need to give up? Where do you need to begin to give a little? And then ask yourself a very honest question. In reality, is it almost always me? Is it almost always me that gets the last word? Is it almost always me that decides they better change? Is it almost always me that has to be in control and have it my way? Then you are the one that's changed the least, and you're not following agape love, because agape love, by Jesus's and Paul's standard, is to be to change anything I need to change within moral sake to reach the needs of my spouse. Do you have a marriage that's hurt and fear and control because of you? Even if it's not visibly apparent, you got to realize that there's a lot of stuff hidden. And maybe the symptoms your spouse is throwing out are all of these. And then the second thing that you need to do, if you see things in your spouse that you don't agree with, where they're controlling and they're cutting and they're hurtful, your first question needs to be, am I adding to that? Am I attacking? Am I criticizing? Am I belittling? Do I never give a good word? Have I stopped praising them? Have I stopped giving them confidence? In short, if your spouse acts the way I've just described, the second question I want you to ask yourself is this: what atmosphere have I created for my spouse to dwell in? One of acceptance or one of condemnation? Because you may be part of the problem. Do they feel second class, threatened, under pressure? Every relationship that's built on agape love, choice to love, without exception, involves a choice. Listen, every relationship built on agape love, a choice to love, involves the choice to change and compromise by both parties, or it won't work. Did you get that? And that change has to come out of a desire to want to meet the needs of your spouse, to satisfy, to protect, to put at ease, to support. This is what God gave me to teach, and I fail at some of it so miserably that I don't want to teach it. But it helps me. So I'll be a better husband for a couple of months until I have to teach it again next year. And that's what true love is. And true love is true success. Listen, 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 listen. True success is not being right or the smartest or winning the argument or not being the righteous leader of your home. True success is having true agape love. Even if your spouse doesn't reciprocate, God will look at you at the success of your marriage by how you loved anyway. Not how successful the marriage was, but how successful you were in trying to make the marriage successful. This is the last scene. I'm going to cry talking about it. Oh, gosh, I got to get over this. This is the last scene of The Notebook. And she got Alzheimer's as they got older. And he gave his house to his children and moved into the nursing home, even though he was in perfect health. Because even though she didn't know who he was, he spent all of his days telling her stories to try and bring back moments here and there of remembrance so he could get a 2-minute time with her. He would spend a week to get 2 minutes of time with her recognition again, because it's all that mattered. And even though she didn't recognize him and she could give nothing to his life, he told his children, "This is the woman that I gave myself to. This is the woman I chose to love. This is the woman I will love, whether it's reciprocated or not. I belong to her. Take my house. This is my home now. My home is where she is." And in her last moment, and this happens, people, I worked in assisted living homes for several years. When people are about to die, people that haven't had a memory for years, they get a surge the last few minutes on earth. And if they've been unconscious, if they've been in a coma, if they haven't had their memory, the last few minutes, God will sometimes, oftentimes, give them this surge of consciousness and remembrance and clarity. And the last few minutes they spend might be the clearest moments they've had in 10 years. Well, she comes back to him in the last few minutes and she realizes who he is. And she says, "You think God would let us die together?" And he said, "Anything's possible." And he climbed up on the bed with her and they died together. And I'm talking like a man. This ain't bothering me. I can talk about this. But let me show you where this really touched my heart. When it shows this scene of him as an old man walking through a nursing home having nothing but a house, and he gave that to his kids, he owns nothing. He owns nothing. He did nothing spectacular. He's walking through a nursing home as an owner of nothing, having done nothing big with his life. He's a blue-collar man going to see a wife that doesn't even know who he is. And this is what he says. "I am nothing special, just a common man with common thoughts. I've led a common life. There are no monuments dedicated to me, and my name will soon be forgotten. But in one respect, I have succeeded as gloriously as any man who's ever lived. I've loved another with all my heart and soul, and to me, this has always been enough." That's what gets me, because it's so real, not because it's a movie. God will not judge you by what job you held, or how smart you got, or how many arguments you won, or how many times you were right over your spouse. You will be considered great in the kingdom of God based solely on how you love. Nothing else. In that respect, how do you look to him based on your marriage? Sometimes I look bad. If you can't love him or her whom you can see, how can you love him who you can't see? Except for your relationship with God, there is no greater indicator of how great you became in God's eyes on this earth than how you treat your spouse, deserving or not. God will not accept that they were not deserving when you tell him that you didn't love them. Everybody in here, at any mental ability, at any money-earning ability, can become one of the greatest in the kingdom of God, starting with how you love your spouse in humility. in light of God's wisdom on change. Man, this guy changed everything about his life. The day he met her on the sidewalk, he said he would. And down to the day he died in a nursing home with nothing, he changed everything about his life to suit her. It's a beautiful story. With God's wisdom in mind on change, with Noah's wisdom in mind on change, listen to this verse again. With loving your spouse by choosing to change in mind. 1 Corinthians 13:1. If I speak in the tongues of men and angels, and I don't have love, I'm a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. I don't care if you've heard this. Don't anticipate the next words. Drink them in. If I have prophetic powers, and I understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to move a mountain, but I don't have love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have, if I deliver up my body to be burned, but I don't have love, I gain nothing. Now, having all prophetic knowledge and speaking with the tongues of angels and moving mountains and burning your body are slightly better than winning that argument and proving you have more college than your spouse. But God says to do all of those things and not have love, you are, quote, nothing in His kingdom. So what's important when you're with your spouse? Creating an atmosphere of love and acceptance, or showing them how much superiority you have? Get over yourself. Learn what's important. Begin to decide there is nothing in my life that is not up for grabs in the change department, if that's what it takes to love my spouse the way I need to, even if they don't deserve it, even if the change might seem unfair to me. If you're choosing your way and your life and your satisfaction over your relationship in God's eyes, you failed, period. Surrender your will and your way and your intellect and your power to God first and then to your mate. The most beautiful words you could ever say to your spouse are, I will give up my life for you. I will change anything I have to. I will work to fulfill your needs and your desires, whatever that requires me to change in my life. I will do it. You tell me what you need. Better yet, you don't have to tell me. I'll watch you till I figure it out. And I'll be that. That, my friend, is agape love. It's the basis for Ephesians 5. It is the mystery of Christ in the church. I'm asking you to take your marriages back, starting with mine. I'm asking you to win your spouse's heart again by changing into anything they need, just like Noah with Allie. Man, whatever you need, that's what I'll be. I won't be light on my feet, honey, because I can't do that. Become one with your soulmate instead of dividing. You need to get with God right now, and you need to ask Him to show you what you need to change. And you need to be willing to do it, no matter the cost, no matter the humility, no matter the embarrassment. You need to be willing to change to make your spouse number one. Let's stand for prayer.